Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 376th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a legendary Welsh actor who has been doing great work on the stage, small screen, and big screen for more than a half century. Racking up along the way one Oscar, two Emmys, and three BAFTA awards, as well as career achievement honors like the Hollywood Foreign Press Association's Cecil B. DeMille Award at the 2006 Golden Globe Awards, and the British Academy of Film and Television Arts' BAFTA Fellowship at the 2008 BAFTA Awards, Sir Anthony Hopkins. Hopkins is best known for his excellent performances in numerous films, among them 1968's The Lion in Winter, 1978's Magic, 1980's The Elephant Man, 1992's Chaplin and Howard's End, 1993's The Remains of the Day and Shadowlands, 1995's Nixon, 1997's Amistad, 2005's Proof, 2019's The Two Popes, and most famously, Jonathan Demme's 1991 horror film, The Silence of the Lambs, for which his portrayal of imprisoned serial killer Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter was recognized with Academy, BAFTA, New York Film Critics Circle, and National Board of Review Awards. The haunting character, which he later reprised in Ridley Scott's 2001 sequel Hannibal and Brett Ratner's 2002 prequel Red Dragon, was chosen in a 2003 American Film Institute survey as the greatest screen villain of all time. In the film, which premiered at Sundance in January 2020, opened in select New York and LA theaters this weekend, will expand to more theaters on March 12th, and will become available for streaming on March 26th, Hopkins plays a man, also named Anthony, who is descending into dementia. Hopkins delivers, in the words of the critic who reviewed the film for the New York Times, quote, an astonishing, devilish performance, close quote, that gave her, quote, actual chills, close quote. And it has brought Hopkins, at the age of 83, pending nominations for Golden Globe, SAG, and Critics' Choice Awards, with Oscar and BAFTA Award nominations almost certain to follow. Over the course of our conversation, Hopkins, who rarely grants interviews, opened up about his accidental path to acting and the early breaks he was given by Sir Laurence Olivier. A major turning point in his life in 1973 when he walked away from the stage and wound up on the screen. What paved the way for his later-than-usual ascendance to stardom via The Silence of the Lambs exactly 30 years ago, and how it shaped the career that he has had since, right through The Father, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Sir Anthony, thank you so much for joining us on the Hollywood Reporter's podcast. It's an honor to have you.
Tony, you don't call me Sir Anthony.
Okay, all right, thank you. On this one, just for a generic opening question that we always do in case our listeners don't know, can you just share where you were born and raised and what your parents did for a living?
Oh, I was raised in a place called Port Talbot, South Wales. My father was a baker.
So reading as much as I could about you from stuff over the years to prepare for this, I was surprised to hear about how kind of demeaning some of your teachers were when you were in school. And I wonder just what that must have been like and if that sort of drove you to prove people wrong.
It's all water under the bridge, you know. They did what they had to do. I've forgotten all that stuff. Yeah, I wasn't very bright at school, and I became an actor, and I've arrived at this point in my life, and I can't even take credit for it because it's beyond me. I don't know why I became an actor. I have no idea. And I mean that. And recently it's come to my consciousness that I have no idea what the hell I'm doing here. I've got a kind of indifference to it all because I started off as a kid, not very bright, you know. I was not very bright. And, you know, naturally, school teachers in those days were impatient with kids. And so, to my surprise and the surprise of many people, school teachers particularly, I became very successful. I was the lowest candidate to have become anything. I don't understand any of it. I don't understand what life is. All I know is I look back over my life and I think, good God, how the hell did that happen? But I can look back now with total, I don't know if the right word is indifference, a total kind of total mystification. I don't know how the hell I got here. nor do I give it any much thought. I'm very lucky. I've had a great life, but no.
Well, is it true that even before acting really entered the picture, if you could have done anything, it seems like music might have been the path, right?
Well, yeah, but I didn't have the technique or the patience to become a musician. But I played the piano, and I was quite good, you know. Technically, I was sort of okay. But I just wandered into this business by accident. At the age of 17, I got a scholarship to Cardiff College of Music and Drama. And that was 1955. And then left in, so, and I had no idea how. I mean, there was an audition advertised in the local paper, and I applied for it, and I learned a piece of Shakespeare. I'd never read Shakespeare, but I learned a bit of it, and I got a scholarship. God knows how. I have no idea how any of this happened. I left in 1957, and then within 10 years of leaving, I was at the National Theatre. And just studying Laurence Olivier. So, you know, to me, it's complete. I have no idea how any of it worked out, and, you know.
Well, the idea, though, of even pursuing a scholarship or schooling in acting, that really, I guess, traced back to the other well-known person to come out of your little town, right? That sort of planted the seed that Richard Burton was someone that you knew of.
Yeah, I went and asked him for his autograph once. I was about 15, and I remember he gave me his autograph, and he and his ex-wife, Sybil, were in, he was staying with his sister. You know, I'd been not far from my father's shop in Tynebach, Port Talbot. And so I went up to ask him for his autograph. And as I was walking down the hill, he and his wife were driving in a Jaguar car to go to Cardiff to see the big rugby international. It was a Saturday, obviously. And I thought, God, I'd love to be like that, you know. And all those things happened to me, and I look back on earth, well, did it make me grow any taller? Did it add anything? You know, am I a better person? I have no idea. But all those things that happened, I suppose I dreamed of and wanted to become. And, of course, now that, you know, life sets in, and I'm now 83 years of age, and I look back, I think, how the hell did this happen? So I've got to have a sense of humor, but I can't take, I mean, I promise you that I cannot take any of this seriously. I mean, I cannot. I used to, I'll be honest, I used to when I was younger, but now I look back and it's all a big game to me.
Well, one of the things that you had said in a long ago interview was that it wasn't even the idea of acting like Richard Burton that was the appeal. It was the idea of being famous. Why do you think you wanted to be famous? Just again to sort of show the doubters, maybe?
I suppose that is, isn't it? I suppose most people want to be successful in their lives, or I don't know whether their motives of revenge. I don't know. It's maybe because I've felt inadequate as a kid. No, I wanted to become something I'll get. But, you know, looking back, my memory is so vague about it now. I don't mean I'm losing my memory, but right. I'm 83, but I look back at it all and it's all like a kind of, it's a bit of a dream.
So you mentioned that, you know, from starting at, I guess, the YMCA at 17 to just a few years later, you're auditioning for the National Theatre in front of Olivier, doing something from Othello that he was actually in at the time. Yeah. I just wonder, was that intimidating for, I must have been, right?
Well, in those days, I was young, I was brash, you know, I didn't give a shit about anything. I was scared, probably. You know, when you're younger, you're arrogant and you think you can do anything. But I was a bit nervous of meeting him, and he was doing Othello. He was playing Othello. So anyway, I got up and did my piece. And he said, well, so what are you going to do next? I said, Othello. He said, you've got a nerve, haven't you? So I did the audition. He said, it's very good. He said, I don't think I'll lose any sleep tonight, but he said, you're very good. So anyway, a few weeks later, I got a call to join the National, and I did, and that was it.
And in fact, isn't it the case that really maybe the biggest break for you while you were there was filling in for him when he wasn't able to do the Dance of Death one night?
Yeah, well, he'd given me a part in Chekhov's Three Sisters, which he directed. And I played the part of Andrei, the brother of the Three Sisters, with Joan Plowright and, anyway, Sir Andrew Robert Sings. And he gave me that part because, I know, he seemed to like me. He thought I was pretty good. He thought I was very strong. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. And I was always pretty prepared, you know, I always knew my lines and all that. But then one day I was given a phone call, and there was the stage manager, Diana Boddington. She said, Florence has gone into hospital. You've got to come in for rehearsal. I said, you're kidding me, because I'd been understudying. Fortunately, I'd learned all my lines. I know that's my only virtue, I think, is that I was very disciplined about learning the text. Very disciplined about that. I think that's a compensation thing to make up for my seeming lack of intelligence, whatever. So I went into the rehearsal and started the rehearsal. And it seemed to go well. It seemed to go very well. And I was on that night. I did four performances. And I said, God almighty. I remember one on the first night I stood there, I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm going to call it. I'm going to say, go home, get your money back. And I remember two boys, soundtracks going in my head. This is crazy. But I got through and I got a standing ovation. And the next morning I got a call from Olivia. And he said, he came out of the hospital, the local hospital, St. Thomas's Hospital, in his bathrobe, the hat and all that, and stood at the back of the auditorium and watched me. He said, well done. And that was it. Yeah. And within that very short period of time, 1967, I got a call from Peter O'Toole to do a film test for The Lion in Winter with Catherine Hepburn. So that, to me, is very odd, very strange and a mystery, because only 10 years before I'd left the Cardiff College of Music and Drama. And in that period, from 1958 to 60, I'd been in national service. Then I went to the Royal Academy. So that was 4 years out of a decade. But within 6 years, something extraordinary happened. But me, I couldn't have designed that. That's nothing to do with me. That's something that is inexplicable about life. We, none of us know what the hell we're doing, really. We all think we know everything. We know nothing.
Well, so I wondered, you know, at RADA, I can't imagine they were teaching very much in terms of screen acting. So all of a sudden, you're on the set of The Lion in Winter, I think in France, I believe. Uh-huh. And did you feel like you were out of your depth, or did you kind of acclimate quickly?
I had it in my nature to. Well, I was always in a state of wonder. I mean, I'd only seen Peter O'Toole in a play at the Bristol Old Vic in 1957, so it was 10 years before, in John Osborne's Look Back in Anger, and he was electrifying. So there I was, in meeting him in his office in Chelsea, I think it was. There were two other actors there, and then I did the film test with him, and he gave me the part. He said, I want you to play the part. So I don't think there's much going on in my head. I just learned the lines, showed up, and did it, and I was pretty strong, you know, physically a strong. I was born that way. I was like a Welsh rugby player. And O'Toole sort of like that, you know, and I had a good voice. And I knew what I was doing. I knew that it took confidence, and I had that confidence. Because, you know, if you're nervous and you keep putting yourself down and you think, well, you know, can't, that's vanity. You have to be confident. You have to know what you're doing. You can't wing it. You can't just say, well, you can't be cool. You got to know yourself. And if you don't know yourself, you're dead. And, you know, people use earphones and all that because they can't learn their lines. So they're too lazy. Well, I mean, maybe they've got a reason for it. I don't know. But I can't do that because my enjoyment is improving my brain, learning the text, and doing it. But you have to be confident. You can't be timid. And that's one thing I'm not. I'm not timid. But then the peculiar dichotomy is I'm not timid, but I'm indifferent to it all. I'm just. I look back over it, what the hell was that all about? Which gives me a great freedom because I realize that, you know, we're nothing. We're not important, or we think we are. We're not. It's a vast universe.
So I did read that you're standing there with Catherine Hepburn, and essentially she's basically telling you that the art of screen acting is to do...
Do nothing.
Nothing, right?
Don't do anything. Just stand there and speak the lines. Like Spencer Tracy and Bogart, they knew how to do it. And O'Toole was the same. O'Toole was great. He was great to work with. We both, he was terrific. And he was another one, O'Toole. He was a great hero of mine because he really he was crazy, but he was a great actor. And he knew his stuff, you know. He really delivered, and he was scary because he had such power and force. And as so many, you know, great American actors have, like De Niro, people have them. But those are the unique ones, you know. The ones that stand above everyone else because they are powerful in their knowledge and their confidence. They don't take prisoners, you know.
People should know that it wasn't like right after Lion in Winter you were suddenly exclusively acting in film. It was actually back to the theater for several years until what seems like it must have been a defining kind of turning point in your life. 1973, you're in Macbeth at the National, and you've just sort of reached your breaking point, and in the middle of the run, you check out. What was going through your mind at the time? Did you worry that this was going to destroy your career? In the end, it actually led to a lot of good things.
Well, you're the first, yeah, very, that's true. I left because I was a bad boy. I just couldn't fit in. I just thought, oh, screw this. And I wasn't a good team player, and I used to hang around, but I was always on my own. I was a bit of a loner, and I'd had enough of this production that I was in, and things had kept going wrong, and I was... and one day I said, that's it. And I left. And I was during rehearsal of the Misanthrope by Molière. And there was a particular director who was a brilliant director, but he was pretty savage. And one day I said, screw you. And I left. And I thought, and I was warned I'd never work again. I said, I don't care. And that's been my attitude all of my life. I remember I told my agent, and he said, you're crazy, you'll never work again. I said, you know, I don't give a shit. I don't care because I don't want to be. I'm not. I was in the army. I was being screamed at by, you know, sergeants. I'm not going to come in this business to be made uncomfortable by some creep. The director turned out to be a great director, but so I remember walking across Green Park and the beautiful January morning, and I thought, and I could hear all the buses and taxis and, you know, going by, and thought, I'm free. I don't ever have to work again. Within a few months, I was in Israel with Leslie Caron, Ben Gazzara, Leah Remick, doing an amazing ABC series called QB7.
Yes.
And I was sitting on a camel, I remember that, like, out here at the National Theatre, and I cooped up in their little dressing room, and out here in the Judean Mountains, riding on a camel. Leslie Caron, and I'm with Ben Gazzara, and Leah Remick, and Jack Hawkins, all these people. And I thought, what the hell happened to me? And there were people, and I was playing a big lead, and there was a wonderful actor, British actor, great actor, big star called Jack Hawkins. Mm-hmm. He was playing the judge, and I remember I couldn't believe I was, you know, I'd seen him 20 years before then in films, and he was such a nice guy, you know, and I actually looped his voice because he had... tracheectomy, and he was about to go to New York to get an operation. He unfortunately died, but so I looped his voice over here in Hollywood. I came over to film Goldie Hawn, and I saw the QB7 final print, and Rene Valente said, what do you think? I said, yeah, but I said, who did Jack's voice? She said, she's an American actor. I said, but it sounds awful. It sounds like a mock English accent. I said, look, I'll tell you what, let me do it. So they paid my extra hotel, and I said, I was about to go back to Britain. And I spent 2 days over in at ABC, I think it was, one of the studios. And I knew how to loop the film, you know. And,
yeah.
And he had a particular voice. And his mouth, you know, as he spoke, his mouth was distorted because he had again, like, so, Adam, your question next, please answer. But I got it. And I saw it. Not bad. I remember meeting Jack's widow, and she said, thank you so much for that. He was such a lovely man, you know. And
all these, I think I remember him from Bridge on the River Kwai, among other things. Yeah. So the director who you'd quarreled with that led you to leave at the National, I believe, was John Dexter. And the greatest irony of all is that when you get to the States, who's the first director who you work with on the theater?
John came out to, I was working with Goldie Hawn on the film. I was in Vienna and I got a phone call that John Dexter was coming to see me. I thought he was coming to arrest me. I met him at the Opera Tavern. It was some place near the Opera House. And John was still the irascible John. He said, so why did you leave? And I said, because you shouted at me and screamed at me. He said, now listen, he said, you're a much better actor than you think you are. So I want you to do Equus in New York. And we became friends. I mean, he was still pretty tough, but we became friends. And I met him, I saw him just last few days of a production I did in London. I worked with him twice. And he was very ill then. And that was the last time I saw him. It was 1989. I was about to go off and make Silence of the Lambs. And I saw him and he looked sad. And I felt sorry for him and I gave him a hug and all that. He died a few months later. But I remember that. And but he was, you know, so these peculiar decisions we make in our lives don't make any sense at all. I thought when I left the National that I'd never work again. But I that's the way I did it. And that's destiny, I guess it's called.
Well, as you arrive in the U.S., as I look back at the credits from that period, QB7 in 1974, the Lindbergh kidnapping case on TV movie, you win an Emmy playing the kidnapper of the Lindbergh baby in 76, Hitler in the bunker in a TV movie in 81, another Emmy. This was, you were working at a high level, it seems like largely on TV at that point. I guess the first, in terms of the big screen after The Lion in Winter, it seems like an important person would have been Richard Attenborough, who I think you worked with more than any other director, if I have it right. Young Winston in 72, A Bridge Too Far in 77, Magic in 78, Chaplin in 92, Shadowlands in 93. Why do you think you two hit it off? Was it that he had also been an actor himself, or why was
so? That? Yeah, I remember reading in the paper I was cast as David Lloyd George in Young Winston. I didn't even know the man. I'd never met him. I mean, never met Attenborough. And I got a call from him. He said, well, could we meet? I said, yes, I want you to do it. I said, well, I read it before you told me in the Evening Seven. So he said, but you'll do it. I said, yeah, of course. And then I was in New York and he wanted me to be in Bridge Too Far with this amazing cast of people. And I was in New York doing Equus at the time. And I went off in 76, thank God, oh my, that's 45 years ago, to Holland. And we started, and that was great. There's Olivia, he was out there. And it's an amazing cast, like Sean Connery. Oh God, they're all there. Robert Redford and Attenborough was directing. And from then on, we did Magic. After Magic, I think, what's it?
Chaplin and Shadowlands, yeah. But he was somebody that you just really clicked with as a collaborator.
He was a very nice man. He was a very good man. Yeah. And he was, you know, a good, solid director. He'd been in the movie business ever since he was a kid. But he'd always, according to a friend of his, Brian Forbes, always been interested in the machinations of McAfee or whatever it is, in the organization of them. And he was always hanging around the production office when he was a young actor. And he was figuring out how to become. Then Gandhi was his first film, I think. No, it was his second film. But he was always interested in it. And he was one of the most pleasant men you could work with. Very jokey, full of fun. And it made it very pleasant to be with all the time. And I had a great time.
Is there any truth to the, I had read that he may have actually floated the idea of you starring in Gandhi? What did you think of that?
I thought he was insane. I said, me? My father said to me, he said, what is it? I told him, he's Gandhi. He said, what is it, a comedy? I said, I stuck with this idea for some years. And one day I had to phone him. I said, I can't do this. Look at me. I'm built like a rugby scrum. And, of course, he got the brilliant Ben Kingsley. But it was an odd thing that he would, and he could politically, he couldn't do that today. But how he did that, I have no idea. But I didn't know why I didn't choose Ben, first of all, because Ben was perfect. So why he spent those years talking to me about it, I don't know.
So right through The Father, it seems like you have had a openness to working with very young, newish directors. And I think that an early example of that would be The Elephant Man with David Lynch, who had only made Eraserhead at that point. What for you gave you the confidence that this was something worth doing when it was a guy who wasn't really that widely known?
Oh, he was a unique director. I mean, he was a real original. And I didn't know how. Can't remember how they gave me that, but it was Mel Brooks directed and produced it. And for some reason, they chose me to do it. And I'd never worked with John Hurt before. I'd known him briefly, but never didn't really know. And we started, and David Lynch was a unique kind of genius, I think. He was. He had a very odd way of directing. He used to do lots of takes. I never knew quite what he was talking about because he would. Because he was another brain, sort of. He was into meditation. All that. He was a very nice guy. I wasn't very well behaved in that because I was, I'm not very good at doing 15 takes, you know. But it was okay. And I saw the film recently, about 2 years ago, I think. I'm a great admirer of his when he did a film with Dennis Hopper.
Blue Velvet, yeah.
Mulholland Drive, and he's a one-off. There's no other David Lynch. He's a one-off. I found Mulholland Drive is an extraordinary film, and the one with Dennis, what was it called?
Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet, yeah.
And actually, didn't one of the films that you directed? I think maybe it was Slipstream. There was some. Sense that it was influenced by David.
Yeah, it was. Well, I wrote that in a month. I just wanted to write a stream of consciousness. And I sat one day and I started writing, and I didn't know where it was going. And I ended up, and I didn't know what it was about. It was based actually on an experience I'd had when I'd had a concussion. I was up in Canada and I had a memory loss through hypothermia. It was the most weird experience of time. Switching around, and I didn't know where I was in the past or the future. And I was told by a doctor, he said, well, that's what happens when you get a lapse of memory. The brain plays all kinds of tricks. And it was such a weird and disturbing experience. It only lasted about a day, I think. I was in Canmore Hospital, I was suffering from hypothermia. But it was such a weird experience. It was all almost out of body experience. And I didn't know who anyone was. The same thing happened to me in Mexico. I was doing a scene in Zorro and trying to break out of a cage or something. And I had the same thing. And the doctor told me, he said, you know, you shouldn't push your brain that far because, you know, you're up in the heights of little oxygen in the mountains in Mexico. So take it easy. So I did. But that's what I do. And I think tiredness, overworking can have an effect on you. And I've always been a workaholic. But anyway, that's what happened to me. And so that's why I wrote Slipstream.
Well, I wonder if those experiences might have been something you drew upon when you did The Father, because it's sort of a disorienting, obviously, thing to play someone with dementia as well.
Well, yes, it is, because in those moments that I had in my own mind, they were scary. They caused a lot of anxiety. I thought, oh, wonderful. And the doctor said, you just have to rest. And within 24 hours, I was back to normal. But it was an odd feeling. It wasn't terrifying, but I thought, God, I hope I can come out of this. And with The Father, it was much simpler because the script is so well written. Florian had created this series of plays, The Father, The Mother, and The Son, and the three different plays, played in New York and all over. Mm-hmm. And then he got this wonderful screenplay writer, Christopher Hampton, who I'd worked with before, three times, I think. Mm-hmm. And people ask me, many interviews say, so how did you get prepared? Well, I just learned the lines. It's that simple, because I don't have any theories about acting, so I don't even know why I'm an actor. But the funny thing is that once you get a good screenplay, a good text, you don't need to mess with it. You may change a word here and there if it suits you, but it's like following a roadmap. So there was no strain, no effort. And I'd go into the studio in the morning, a little tiny studio in London, and I'd meet Olivia Colman, a wonderful actress, and the rest of the cast were wonderful. Yeah. And Florian, this was his first film. So for me, it was... as they say over here, walk in the park. It was dead easy, really. It was no big deal.
Well, I'm going to come back and ask you more, of course, about The Father, which I had actually been lucky enough to see on Broadway. So it was quite interesting to see the ways that you guys approached it.
You saw it on Broadway?
Yes, yes. It was really interesting to then see how it was tailored for the screen. But before, I want to kind of stick to the chronology for a moment, though, if I can, because you went back to England, having kind of fled with Macbeth in 73, 74. A decade later, you went back. Why did you decide to give it a second chance that only was interrupted, I guess, eventually when Silence of the Lambs came about?
Well, I was living out here. I enjoyed it. I loved living out here. And then gradually things began to dry up. And I was with an agency who was now a famous producer. And he was my agent for a while. I won't mention him. But I said, I'm going back to England. And I said, listen, thank you for being my agent. He said, that's okay. I said, I'm going back to England because I've been offered. I was doing The Bounty in 1980. Mm-hmm. And I think I was offered a play called Pravda by David Eyre. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to England and I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to England and stay there. I didn't know what was going to. And I'd never been back. I hadn't been in the theatre for many years. And I went back to do Pravda and a few other films. Like, I can't remember, Married Man or something like that. But anyway, Pravda was the thing. And David Eyre was the director. He wrote it, Howard Brenton, he was the director. Brilliant director, David Eyre was. He is. But he sometimes directs films. But it was about the height of my life because it was such fun, so much fun playing a monster tycoon, a press baron.
Right.
Called Lambert LaRue. But it was a wonderful part, and David was the best. And then I did King Lear with him. David's production was great, but I wasn't too. I was too young. I was in my 40s. And you can do it at the point you can. You have to wait until you're 83. So I was 80 when I did Lear again. Mm-hmm. Because I knew more about life, I guess. But David was a wonderful director. And then what happened? I think after that, I did a play, did several plays and television things. Oh, my God, I kind of forgot.
Well, I think Butterfly, right? M. Butterfly?
Butterfly, yeah. In New York, in London, M. Butterfly. And Lynn Farley, and I can't remember. But anyway, I was doing M. Butterfly, 1989, and a call came through from my agent. He said, send me a script called The Silence of the Lambs, and I thought it was a kid's story. I was sitting in my dressing room, and it was a hot summer afternoon. So I read it, and I phoned him back. I said, is this an offer? He said, I'm not sure yet. I said, I don't want to read anymore, because he said, why? I said, because this part is the best part I've ever read. It's not a very big part. I said, I don't care. I don't want to read it, but it is. So later he said, Jonathan Demme is coming to see you tomorrow on Saturday night. So Jonathan came to see the play that night, the Saturday night. And I said, this is an offer. Yeah. And within a few weeks, my contract was up and I left and came over to New York and we had a reading with Jodie Foster at the Orion offices in New York. And I knew how to play that actor. I just knew it. I don't know how, but I knew it. And it creeped them out a bit. So I was a little bit unsure of that. I was confident, but I thought, well, I'm not an American actor. And I'm sure there'd be a couple of raised eyebrows, not that anyone gives a hoot about it. We think that people think about this. Nobody's giving a hoot about us. But I remember sitting in the office at the round table reading, and there was a reaction from my voice and all the people said, oh, my God. And then we started the film in Pittsburgh about some months later. And that was it. And so when I arrived, I knew exactly what to do. You know, that's, again, it takes confidence to know that.
Well, let me just ask you, do you know what it was that made Jonathan even think of you at a time when you felt that the industry had almost sort of, the American industry had sort of forgotten you, I guess. That's why you went back to England. So was it that?
It's natural. You know, I'm not an American-born actor. And of course, the American film industry is different to the British film industry. You know, it's different. I suppose I was cast in that mold of the upright British gentleman. So not that I am any of that, but so I understood that. That's why I went back to England, and I thought I'd love to come back to America. I had little notion that it would happen that way, and I knew that Silence of the Lambs would be a big hit because the script was so... Ted Talley wrote the script and it was so concise and so accurate, and Jodie Foster was just wonderful to work with. She had none of that movie star nonsense about it. She was nice, ordinary, very nice woman, and we worked it well together. And then the film was shown and it came out. I discovered friends I never knew I had before. What an impression. But, you know, that's the life. And that's what happened. And I was nominated and all that. I didn't expect to get that. I was up against Nick Nolte and De Niro and Robin Williams. So to my surprise, when I got that award, I thought, oh, my Moses. I didn't even have a speech to make. you know, so all this to me is a mystery. So that's why I think I've built a sort of benign indifference to it all. And I don't mean to say indifferent or cynical, just kind of, that's it. Don't live with expectation.
Yeah, yeah.
State of total non-expectation. And surprisingly enough, when you give up wanting things, things happen to you. And I think that's the secret that I might have stumbled on, you know, screw it, stop expecting things and things may work out, or they may not.
Well, and the things that made that character so just unforgettable, his posture standing straight up, the lack of blinking, the way he spoke. I think it's interesting, you know, you say you knew how to play it right away, but there are the things that one draws upon. You, who is Christopher Fetz?
Oh, he's a teacher in London, the London Drama Centre. He taught at RADA, and he was a Stanislavski teacher, and he was pretty assertive. He was pretty savage on students, but he was a brilliant, brilliant intellectual. And now he's almost like a psychiatrist. It was called the Laban theory of movement, of psychological gesture, which Michael Chekhov talks about. So it's very Stanislavski oriented in method and all that. So I studied with Christopher and his partner, Yat Mangrin. And I wasn't a good student, but years later when Silence of the Lambs came out, because they were always over my neck, you know, because they were hypercritical of everything. And students were scared of him. And Christopher was one of those guys. And I got a call from him. He said, I saw you in Silence of the Lambs. He said, well done. He said, well done. So we went out for dinner and Yat, and they were both pretty harsh critics of actors. And they paid me such a great compliment. I thought, well, my life is made. Because, you know, though you've got your teachers over your back all the time, haunting you for the rest of your life. And so I was pleased with that. But by that time, I'd known a few, my way through the method and Stanislavski and all that. You know, I'm fairly well-versed in it. I wouldn't say I have to sit in the corner vegetating, pretending I'm a tree or anything. But I learned that. And for my method is that, once you've filled your head with the thoughts of it, it was the same with the lecture. I knew exactly what, because the language is there. It's there. I mean, I don't have to act it.
But something that you added, I mean, you're very humble about it, but you, I mean, something like the way his voice sounded, that was your contribution, right? The idea that he sounded like something else that you knew from cinema?
Well, I wanted to make him like a machine, like HAL, the computer in 2001. Because I knew that I said to John, he says, how do you want to play it? This way, we had dinner that night in London. I just felt like I'd like to play him like kind of disembodied, like Good Evening Day. He said, oh my God, Good Evening Day. Have you thought about the strip, Dave? It's Good Evening, Clarice. You know, as he looked like to me, he got back in the cheap shoes. He's a computer, brilliant. And in the examination in the cage, no, what does he covet? That was Chris Fetz. What does he covet? No. Probing. And what he is, and I figured it out at that point, that he's her lover in a way, that he is a seducer, that in fact what he's doing is stripping away her mask. So he knows she's a better person than all this bullshit she's pretending to be so confident. He knows she's a vulnerable woman and she's got the courage to come into this monstrous situation with all these big FBI guys around her. And he admires her, but he's going to teach her some lessons. Tell me about the lambs, Clarice. Quid pro quo. And he does an analysis on her, and he strips her off her mask. And he knows, she knows he would never harm her. because he admires her. Mm-hmm. But he's her mentor. He said, you follow my tricks and you'll have a better life. Now, he's locked in the prison, so his life is not so good. But she, so that much I knew.
That's amazing. And I just spoke with Jody for an interview about a week ago, and we were talking about the fact that you guys, it must not have been easy to film those scenes where you're talking to each other. It appears through the glass because you're looking into the camera. She's not there really when you're speaking. It's in super close up. I guess, was that a strange way of working for you?
No, it was a long evening. I was working till 4 o'clock in the morning. It was once you got to, because Jodie would be behind the camera, and I'd be behind the camera for her. And in those days, they didn't have monitors, you know. The director was there with you. And Jonathan was very particular about that. He'd say, okay, let's do one more take and another. We did about 5 takes on each. And I was game for that because it was easy. And I'd already got my game plan in way. And she was such a professional herself. And so it was easy. And his objective, to use Stanislavski, his objective in that scene was to penetrate the mask and strip it down. Anyway, to make her a better, what he's doing, he's psychoanalyzing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just one little kind of trivial tidbit I'm curious about. The tongue thing, was that scripted or was that you just in the moment?
In the moment.
now you can't get away from it.
I just got a bit hacking to me at the moment. So I've been some nice candy. I remember Jonathan said, oh my God, you're so... I knew it would scare people because I was very influenced by... I'd read the Bram Stoker's, you know, Dracula, years before. Yes. And when Count Dracula sees Jonathan Harley, he cuts himself with a razor. And that to me, when I was a kid, I'd seen Bela Lugosi in film, and those images haunted me, as they do with kids, you know. We all have those anxieties. And that one moment, you go, that's the most terrifying moment of all. It's the nightmare that we all carry deep in us, inside us. There is a dark figure inside us that we know about. And if we are healthy, we confront it. We make friends with it. Because this is the shadow. If we don't, it'll take us apart, you know.
It's amazing. And you know what? I think people are, their mind is blown when they hear that. I think somebody calculated it. You're in that movie for about 21 minutes, and yet it feels like you're there every minute. You won Best Actor, not Best Supporting Actor. It was really an example of somebody making such an impression with the time they have in a movie. I don't think there's anything like it.
Well, I'm very flattered to say that. Well, how was it? It was 21 minutes?
21 minutes.
Holy Moses, I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, I've never taken these facts into consideration. But yeah. Yes, it was... Yes, it's a wonderful time. It was a wonderful part to play. And I remember when I saw the film in New York, it was sort of a final print, but not quite. And I sat with one of the producers, Ed Saxon, I think it was. We sat in the movie theater, and I think they'd added the score, or they were about to add the score to it. And I watched it, and I thought, oh, my God, this is a great movie. And Ed said, what do you think? I said, it's fantastic. And he said, I think it's a winner. He said, I think this is going to be bigger. My sense it would be. Also, but don't forget, the book was very popular. Because when I got to New York for the first reading, I remember somebody saying to me, you're here to do Silence of the Lambs? I said, yeah, what part are you playing? I said, Hannibal Lecter. They said, oh. I'd simply be saying, you know the book? Oh, my God, you haven't read the book. I said, I'm about to read it. And I read it. So I knew it was... As I say, you know, you have to have the confidence to know. It's not a question of ego. You just have to know precisely what you're going to do. And that's what I do. That's my trick of trade, I guess.
So that period in your life, as you look back, I mean, that movie came out, I believe, in February of 91. More than a year later is when the Oscars happened.
Came out on Valentine's Day.
On Valentine's Day, that's right. 30 years. Yeah, we just had the 30th anniversary. So comes out then, more than a year later at the Oscars, it becomes only the third movie ever to win picture, director, actor, actress, and screenplay. And at that point, I have to think, maybe even well before that, probably, your life was and your career was probably never the same. And I guess I just wonder, I think at that point you had already committed to do Howard's End. You may have been contemplating doing Dracula to play Dr. Van Helsing, just to show that you could do something totally different right after. I don't know. But just what do you remember about the moment when suddenly the world was at your fingertips?
Well, you never really believe that. If you start believing that, if I started believing that, I'd be dead. You can't believe that. You know, that's what kills a lot of people. But I don't mean kills, but you can't anticipate things like that. Life goes on, and you wake up in the morning, you look in the shaving mirror, and you're again. But, you know, life goes on, you survive, and you do a couple of films. And I was, to my surprise, was called up by someone representing Francis Ford Coppola. And I think it was Winona Ryder suggested me. Anyway, so I was happening to come to, I think it was just after Howard's End, I'm not sure. Or maybe Howard's End was after. And anyway, so I came to my own and met Coppola, and he was a very friendly guy. And so we did that, Gary Oldman, although I'd never worked with him before, but I knew Gary. I didn't know him that well. And that was at MGM a long time ago. 1991, it was September, I think, 1991. I think I'd done Howard's End before that. Mm-hmm. I think so. And I went back to England and, I'd been nominated, that's right. And I was in Switzerland doing a film with Charlie Chaplin, about Charlie Chaplin. Richard Attenborough's directing. And I was in the trailer one afternoon and having my lunch, and Attenborough came in and said, "You've been nominated for the Oscar." I couldn't believe it. Because 40 years ago, I'd seen Chaplin's film The Limelight. If you told me then, I'd say, "Get out of here, crazy." So it's all very strange. And I know I keep going on about it. I can't account for any of it. So, I'm off the hook because I can't account credit for any of it. So that's why I'm benignly indifferent to it all.
Well, I do want to note that Howard's End was 1992, The Remains of the Day, 1993, both Merchant Ivory movies, both you and Emma Thompson, and both just tremendously acclaimed for you giving performances that are could not be further from Hannibal Lecter, right? I mean, these are kind of period piece mannered guys. I just wonder if you liked working in the kind of period piece costume drama that type movie that Merchant Ivory, you know, is forever associated with.
Yeah, whatever they put you in, you know, you just stand there and put the clothes on. 100 years old. I remember on Howard's End, I had to wear a moustache and I didn't want to. And so the makeup said, "Would you try a moustache?" And I put it on, and suddenly I thought, that's him. Because, you know, it's accidents. You put something on, Stanislavski talks about it, and actors talk about it. You put on a pair of gloves or you put on, and something happens. It's like Gene Hackman when he's playing Pop Doyle, and somebody gave him a hat or something, and he was drinking coffee and eating a donut during a break, and suddenly he became Pop Doyle, you know, and those things happen. And it's a very strange process. You suddenly put something on and you think, good God. And I remember, you know, playing the father, for example, just in the dressing gown or the bathroom. And things like that with Van Helsing or whatever they are, you know.
Well, so with Henry Wilcox for Howard's End, it was the mustache. With Stevens, the butler in Remains of the Day, was it the outfit? Was it something else there for that one?
Well, you just don't speak too loud. Stand still a lot. You don't know. It's you put that on. But it's easy. It's not difficult. You put on a bunch of clothes that you have to wear for the character. And, they may do something for you. They may make you feel whatever you feel like. Because I've never been dressed as a butler before in my life. But I'm a butler. There's no big deal about it.
So that was Remains of the Day in 93, which was the same year as your final collaboration with Attenborough with Shadowlands. And then comes the role that I believe you have said, you called it, quote, an act of madness, close quote, and quote, the hardest, toughest one I've done, close quote. And that was playing Richard Nixon in Nixon for Oliver Stone. And I'm just really curious, because it seems like so many of these might have been demanding and challenging. What was it about Nixon that was so difficult for you?
Everything, because he was an American president and I was born in Wales.
Yes.
Oliver was mad to cast me. I said, you're crazy. Anyway, I meant to meet him in London. I turned it down and he said, let's meet anyway. So I went for breakfast with him in the Hyde Park Hotel. It was a cold January morning, I thought. And I remember stopping. I thought, well, I can either work with this crazy man or can say have a respectable career for the rest of my life, doing Ibsen and Chekhov and all that, nothing wrong with that. But I can meet. And I met Oliver. I said, I'm going to do it. He said, good. And then what is great is Oliver's the most challenging director you can ever work with, because he won't let you get away with it. And he constantly pulls the carpet from underneath you because he likes to see you on set. He's a real genius, I think. He's a brilliant director. And I had a great time with him. It was a tough role to play, because, you know, I wanted to get the sound of the voice right. And I was surrounded by American actors. And we did the reading, and James Woods came over to me and said, great German accent. James Woods. But no, it was a wonderful experience. And I loved working with Oliver. And, he was great. And the one cast.
It was a great, great, great performance. And I do want to come back to something you were just talking about, where do I want to be doing Ibsen? Do I want to be doing Shakespeare? One of my favorite quotes of yours that I came upon was, this was an interview with Playboy, I think 1994, quote, I don't like Shakespeare. I'd rather be in Malibu. I think it's great. And you know what? The truth is, if you gave truth serum to most actors, they would probably say the same thing, right?
I admire people, you know, the people, wonderful actors like Ian McKellen and Judi Dench, people like that, and countless others. They go on stage night after night, you know, they enjoy it. But I don't know how they do it, but they've got the stamina. And I can't do that. I remember I had the run of M. Butterfly for 9 months, and I thought, I'm going to go crazy. And I knew an actor, Lionel Jeffries, he's dead and gone now, but he said, this was like being... I think it was Judi Dench. The best part is getting the phone call inviting you to do it. After that, sort of.
M. Butterfly was the last time you've done stage work, right?
I did an adaptation of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya on stage in Cardiff in Wales and Theatre Clwyd in North Wales. And I made a film as well. But yeah, that was the last.
So you played President Nixon in Nixon. Then you played President John Quincy Adams in Amistad and for Spielberg. And I read a story that I have to just share with our listeners, because I think it's a testament to your abilities. Just there's something about the way your mind works that you, I think, in like no time memorized a 7-page speech that the cast and crew, I think they gave you an ovation or something at that when you did it. What, you have a very specific technique for memorizing lines, right?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I go over them. It's maybe it's obsessive, maybe that's why it works. It's like a kind of magic number. I go over a part of role 200 times, 300 times. I go over and over and over until I've absorbed and eaten or devoured the lines so much in my head that they become part of me. But once you have had that, you see, once you know somebody else's language, which is not mine, but it's whoever's written it, Ted Talley or Christopher Hampton, it's his fiction. It's his. They're not mine. But I've absorbed all that stuff. Like, it's like eating oatmeal in the morning. I'm not the oatmeal, but I take the oatmeal and, you know, it's the same as the day, or I have whatever. And so you take in words and it sustains you. And it's like a diet of words. So they're in you. And the more you know it, the more you know it. And the more relaxed you become, and you go on set and think, right, I'm ready to go. Boom, boom.
And you mark up your scripts, right? They're sort of hieroglyphics almost, right?
Yeah. It's like, I mean, I wouldn't compare myself to Muhammad Ali, but it's like Muhammad Ali or, you know, Mike Tyson doing 300,000 press-ups. You know, it's dancing. It's like a great dancer. You've got to know your steps. You can't dance unless you know. It's like a great singer, Pavarotti or whoever. You know, you have to, not that I'm any near that, but that is a technique. You cannot go by any other means. There's no way through it. You think you, if anyone who thinks they can, they're fools. They're stupid because you can't do it. So you have to know exactly what you're going to do. And then you can adapt. You can rope it up. You can do, you know, you can dance around the ring. But you can improvise within the structure. And that's what makes it so liberating. But you still have to then not take yourself too seriously.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And I think one of your most underrated or underappreciated performances was in Proof. I don't know if it wasn't distributed well or what, but I think it's one that you're also proud of, right? It was good.
Good as Falter, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think as the professor, anyway, just any thoughts you have on that?
Oh, I had a wonderful, it's a long time ago. It's 900 years ago.
That was like 2005, I think.
That's right. It was in Chicago. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Gwyneth was wonderful to work with, and John Madden. It was, well, again, I had a lot of lines to learn, and I was confident in that. I knew what I was doing and knew what I was going to do. And I didn't know, you know, I saw the film, but I didn't know if it was rated at all. Yeah, it was one I enjoyed. It's, you know, you can say we're proud of them. It's, I just look at them. Did I enjoy them? I enjoyed King Lear recently, and the professor with Ian McKellen, a wonderful actor. All big surprises, you know, to get work with people like Ian McKellen and doing the two popes with Jonathan Pryce. You know, I had to learn Latin and Italian.
Well, that's the one that I have to ask you about next, because I thought that was the best movie of whatever it was, 2018. You guys were unbelievably good together, and it was just fascinating to watch every little kind of twitch and mannerism that you gave Pope Benedict. And I just wonder, I know you say you stick to the script, but was there something there where did you look at footage of Benedict? Was there other things? Because you nailed that one. I thought that's as good as anything you've done.
I saw bits of the Pope on the balcony when he receives the blessing on that. And you know that you imitate that look and the looks and gestures, as I did with Nixon. I watched Nixon's farewell speech to the White House, many of his speeches over and over and over, until you get a sense of it. But with that, and then with Jonathan, who's a different kind of actor to me, and I didn't know Jonathan at all well. We'd met, you know, a few times. But he was terrific. Now I like to learn it all. He just comes in as a chance, and that he was so easy to work with. And whatever his method is, it's different to mine. But we seemed to coalesce and work together. And we had a nice joke together because he was number one on the call sheet. He used to call me number two. I said, yeah, but I'm Sir Number Two. So we had a lot of fun. You've got to have that. If you don't have fun with it, you're dead, and you can't. You've got to have fun. Yeah,
that is a fantastic one. And then to follow that with The Father, which I think you've said, here's an interesting quote to just get us into The Father. Quote, two scripts had an immediate impact on me. One was Silence of the Lambs. The other was The Father, close quote. Was it it was just something that you read it and you knew, I've got to play this guy?
Yeah, because it's very simply written, very direct, very simple and concise. And that's the art of great screenplay writing. Chris Hamden's one of those. And I'm glad he's been nominated for. But what's his name? Florian Zeller. I'm just going to meet Florian in a few minutes, so I've got first-time director. It's extraordinary. And it was so easy. It was so simple. We had a lot of fun. No, I mustn't take anything too seriously.
Yes. Had you ever had to play a character before who has to convey such a range of emotions? One minute he's charming, the next minute he's abusive, one minute he's scared, the next minute he's resigned.
Well, you just follow the course of the script.
Yeah. Do you feel that with the passage of time, you know, do you continue to get better as an actor? I think so. You're doing some of the best work ever the last two movies, but how do you feel about it? What's left to achieve at this point?
Well, I got a couple of films coming up, and if we ever get out of this pandemic, I'm sure we will. I just love to work, you know, and I like to have a laugh with it. I like to have a lot of fun with it, and I love doing it. It's a it beats working. I'll tell you that. It's called great Robert Mitchum. He said, why do you act in films? Sure beats working.
Well, I can't thank you enough for all the great entertainment and for doing this. And just thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.